you very much indeed, and thank you for coming to this talk. It's a great pleasure to see you and to be part of the very rapid expansion of relations between Cambridge and China. I won't be able to speak for very long. I think I've got about 35 minutes because I want to have some questions. We only have an hour. If you're interested in anything I say and want to pursue this at all, do have a look at my website. All you need to do is to Google my name, Alan McFarlane, and it will take you to my website at the top. And then you can explore all sorts of teaching materials, 150 interviews with leading Cambridge and other academics, films and so on, and also 600 films on YouTube and all sorts of other things. So this is just a taster of my work. The first question I want to address is understanding another culture or civilization desirable or necessary? I don't think I need to try and persuade you of that fact, since you're here in Cambridge and learning about Western civilization as well. But obviously, because we now live in a global world where we're all interconnected, and your presence here is an example of it, and we live in a world where different civilizations are having huge impacts on each other, that the West was made by China, as you know. The Needham Institute here in Cambridge is a good example of how the West was made by Chinese science and civilization. And now China has been remade by the West, and so it goes back and forth. So we need to understand our mutual civilizations. The question then is such understanding of another culture possible? I know that it would be impossible for me to know China in the way that you know it. And indeed, it seems philosophically that it's more or less impossible to know another culture, just as it seems very difficult to know how we could understand another human being. But in fact, I think one needn't be too pessimistic, because one can sort of know places. One can't know them as well as the native inhabitants in certain ways, but you can begin to. In other words, it's not either knowing or not knowing, it's on a continuum of knowing it very well, knowing it a bit. And one has to have the faith or belief as a social scientist that we can know the other a little anyway. Like, in the same way, a historian can't really know the past. The past, in the famous phrase of L.P. Hartley, is a foreign country, but you can visit it and learn a little bit about it and have a feeling that you know bits of it. Of course, the difficulty is that it's what we call a circularity. In order to know something, you already have to know it partly. One of the great difficulties for you coming to Cambridge is that much of it must seem very confusing and baffling, because you don't know any of it. Gradually, as you know bits of it, other bits become comprehensible, and that is my own experience of working in other cultures. The best way to really know another culture quite well is either to spend your whole life studying it, learning the language and so on, which I've never done with China or with Japan. But a shortcut to this is to get to know one or two people in that culture really well. This is my way of understanding other cultures, and it also applies to my own fieldwork in the Himalayas in Nepal, where I got to know three or four people really well and became very deep friends. We could talk and we had shared experience, and you can cross cultural barriers in that way by getting to know a few people really well. The same was my experience with Japan. I got to know two Japanese academics, and we had long discussions. They came and stayed with us, and we went to stay with them. And so they became deep friends, and friendship and constant revisiting makes it possible to enter another culture deeply. The next question I want to ask is, are some societies easier to understand than others? very obvious that if there is a huge gap between civilizations and cultures, between your own experience and the other experience, then it is very difficult to understand across this gap. It was a famous remark of the philosopher David Hume that he more or less said, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, however intelligent you are, you can be absolutely brilliant, but if your own experience doesn't overlap with the experience of the thing you are trying to understand, like another civilization, there is no way by pure rational thought that you can enter into that other experience. And the gap between civilizations is often so large, and this is often the experience of anthropologists, and I'm by background an anthropologist as well as a historian, that there you've got nowhere to start your understanding from, because everything is strange. Now, that gap is different between different civilizations. Just to take an example, for an American, if I was an American rather than an English person, if I was American, I would find, I think, England not too difficult to understand. Very puzzling. I have American students and they say England is really very puzzling to civilization divided by a common language, as Oscar Wilde or someone put it. So even England is difficult for Americans, and I find America difficult as an English person. But for an American, something like Italy might be even more difficult because it's not got the same Anglo-Saxon background. Such an American would, I think, find China very puzzling, or parts of China, but not as puzzling as Japan. And I'll explain why I think Japan is even more difficult for an American to understand. And it will be the same for you. There will be, talking to my Chinese students and my Japanese students, they find England easier to understand on the whole than some of the continental countries they visit, or even America. So the distance of the gap is one of the features. Another feature is the depth of the history of the place you are trying to understand. Much of the world is very modern. For example, the white part of the British Empire, Australia, Canada, and America, North America, is very modern by your standards of China. In other words, it's only 200, 300, 400 years old. And consequently, the history has been short and everything is fairly shallow and simple, relatively. The same is true on a lesser scale with universities. When I was at the London School of Economics, for example, which is only, 100 years old or something like that, perhaps a little more, it seemed a very simple structure, very centralized and very simple. You could spend a week with a couple of books and you more or less knew how the LSE worked, and the same with most of the new universities in this country, and most of Chinese universities, which are pretty recent too, or Japanese ones. On the other hand, Cambridge, which is 800 years old, as you know this year, is very difficult to understand because it's had such a long history. And the same is true of certain civilizations. Old nations like England, which its history is continuous for at least 1,000 years, Japan, which is slightly older than that, and certainly China, are especially difficult to understand. In order to understand a place, you often the best technique is what's known as finding the point of origin, where it started, how it evolved. This is a phrase from de Tocqueville, a political thinker. And the point of origin of China in particular, but even Japan and England, is 1,000 years ago. The point of origin of America is only 400 or 500 years ago at the most, and of other places much shorter. So they are much easier to understand. A third determinant of the difficulty is the degree of variation across the civilizations. England and Japan, two of the places I've studied, are relatively easy in that respect because they're small islands. Japan, of course, is a huge geographical range of temperature and climate because it's very long and thin, but it's land mass is quite small and the inhabited land mass is very small, and England is relatively small. On the other hand, if you take a place like India, India is not just a civilization. India is many civilizations. You can go 1 kilometer or 1 mile in India and be in another civilization, not just in another street or even another subculture, but another civilization. And it's made of many civilizations. In comparison to India, certainly, China is in the middle. It's not as small and simple to comprehend as Japan or England, but it's not like India. At least not over the hand yet part of China. It's been unified again and again, and there is a lot of unity. When I travel, and I travel from the northwest, from Liaoning province, through the center, right down the east, or to a certain extent in the east, and down to the southwest to Yunnan, which I've been to several times, I don't feel in Liaoning or Yunnan that I'm in totally different worlds. A lot of it seems to have a lot of common features to it. But if you do that in India, you feel you're in different civilizations. And finally, there is the degree to which the social structure is varied. If you have a society which has layers, in other words, castes and classes, then the differences between the castes and classes may make it very difficult to generalize or to understand the civilization, because you have to understand each layer. In this case, England has an extreme class system and always has had and still has. And so there is a lot of differentiation between the experience, say, of a manual worker or someone working in the countryside and someone who is in an office in London to a certain extent. And in India, of course, it's even more with the caste system. In that respect, China again seems to be in the middle. It doesn't seem quite. I mean, there are obviously huge differences, but the great difference in the traditional past has been between the educated, the literati, the Mandarin class, and the rest. So there were really two groups you had to understand, not a whole series of groups as in the caste system. Summarizing all this together, some civilizations are difficult to understand, almost impossible to understand, because they're so complex and varied, and it's difficult to make generalizations about it. And when I think the greatest book on understanding of civilization was written, which is de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, he said that he could spend 6 weeks or 2 months in America and understand it, because it was all laid out in a very regular pattern. If you stood in the middle of America, as it were, in your mind, you looked down this road, you could see right to the end of the road of equality. You could look down to individualism. You could look down to fraternity. You could look down to Puritanism, Puritan religion. If you understood these four roads, you could stand and you could read, as he did, the whole of American, North American civilization off in a few weeks. Tocqueville, who was married to an English wife and spent a lot of time in England, and wrote a lot about England, though he never published a single book on it, described how England, because of its point of origin is very old, is like an ancient path, and you have to walk the whole path. You have to start with the Anglo-Saxons, and then William the Conqueror, and round, and then it goes round here, and then it goes round there. And only when you've been along all these paths, winding paths over its history, can you understand it. And he said it would take him several lifetimes to begin to understand England. This is roughly the same as my analogy with universities. You can stand in the middle of the London School of Economics or the School of Oriental and African Studies or a modern American university and read it off more or less very quickly. But in Cambridge, with 800 years, I've spent nearly 40 years here and I still don't begin to understand it. As you will discover if you're interested, just if I may make a plug, I've written for my Chinese students in particular, I wrote this, a book on how Cambridge works called Reflections on Cambridge, which will be coming out in the autumn. And it is the result of 40 years here in all sorts of positions in colleges and in my faculty and departments, as an anthropologist, as a historian, trying to understand the principles behind Cambridge. And it's only really scratching the surface of it. It may help you, but it's only beginning to understand it after 40 years. Because Cambridge is a miniature of the English system. The English system is a decentralized ancient feudal system like Japan, and therefore it has many layers, and it's not the simplicity of an archaeology. To a certain extent, archaeological strata like this are quite easy to understand because you bore down and you see the Song, the Ming, the Qing, the Chairman Mao's, and you understand them as a series of layers. But Cambridge and England and Japan are what is known as palimpsests. That means that when in the old days you didn't have much writing paper, you used to write across them like that, and then you turn the writing and you write across them like that, and you might do that two or three times. Or you have leaves falling on each other and they blend into each other, so that you don't have separate layers. And Cambridge is very difficult to understand, as is England, because it is mixed up. Something from four centuries ago may be affecting your lives without you really knowing it, or you understanding it, and something from yesterday. And they're all mixed together. There's no separation into archaeological levels. Now, I want to move on now to my attempts to understand different civilizations, and because time is short, I will keep it very brief. My first attempt was to understand England. And in this attempt, I wasted an awful lot of time, because all my teachers and all my teaching and everything I learned about England as a historian, studying at Oxford University, my undergraduate degree and my doctorate at Oxford, sent me in a certain direction towards an understanding of the past of this country, which only later I discovered was almost completely wrong. You probably know about paradigms. The paradigm for the study of English history, which I was taught at school and then at Oxford University, I suddenly realized quite late on in my life, when I was in my mid-30s, was completely mistaken. And I only realized this by going a long way away from England, just as you've gone a long way from China. You can't see it. Most of my friends were educated here. They went on and they wrote about England and so on. And there's a saying, he little of England knows who only England knows. I had to go to the Himalayas and then come back, and then I began to see what was wrong with the framework which I'd inherited from my teachers. And I realized that England was, the framework which they had developed had been very heavily influenced by Marxism and by a universal evolutionary theory about how societies develop. They go through stages, feudal and peasant, capitalist and modern. And so England had been slotted gradually into this framework. And suddenly I discovered that this was wrong, that it had never gone through the Marxist transition from feudalism to capitalism. That in fact, to paraphrase the famous title of a book by Bruno Latour, he wrote a book called We Had Never Been Modern. What I discovered was that we had always been modern, that England was born modern in the sense of modernity as a separation of economy from society, from politics, from religion. There were these separations very early on. I took my story back in the book that was mentioned, The Origins of English Individualism, back to the 12th, 13th century, and then in subsequent books I take it back to the Anglo-Saxons. This actually was what, you go back 100 years, the greatest historian of England was a lawyer at Downing College here, F.W. Maitland. If you're interested, you'll find a book I wrote on him, which you can get down as an electronic book free from my website. But Maitland realized, he was a great student of English legal records, and he knew that England had never been feudal peasant in the sense that Marx or others would come to describe it. It had been a series of very small evolutionary steps from an original situation which had modified gradually. And this is perhaps something that I would like to stress. If you're trying to understand the history of China or any other civilization, you will probably be faced, without really thinking about it, with two models of how time and these civilizations change over time. These two models are what you might call a revolutionary model and an evolutionary model. The revolutionary model says that you have a civilization A, and then it goes through a revolution, and then you have B, and then you have C, and then you have D. The evolutionary model says that you have an initial situation which evolves, not from A to B, but to A1, A2, A3, A4, like that. So a lot is retained and doesn't change, but all the time very small changes are occurring. This is Darwinian, and it's appropriate to be talking about this in the year of the Darwin memorials. It's what has been described as a summary of Darwin's theory as random variation and selective retention. Things change very randomly, small changes, and this is how animal species change. They don't suddenly, one day they're a bird and the next day they're a crocodile. The bird develops something here a little further back, like that. And this kind of evolutionary change occurs in some societies. The well-documented two great examples of this are Japan and England. Most societies tend to go through revolutionary changes. They go along like this, and then the forces build up so much there's an explosion. And you have the French Revolution, you have the Russian Revolution, you have the Chinese Revolution. In fact, of course, a lot is preserved, and we're finding in China now that a lot that was thought to be lost is coming back again. And this is the point that Tocqueville makes about the French Revolution. It wasn't so revolutionary as people thought. On the other hand, there is a big switch, a huge switch. I often think of England and Japan as like trees. That you have a little tree, you have the roots, an organic metaphor, and it grows up, and then it puts off a twig here and a branch there, and so, and it grows like that, and you have, after a while, you have a big tree. But the roots and the trunk are very old. There has never been a revolution in England. The English Revolution was not a revolution at all. But many societies, they grow up and then they cut it all off. And China is like that. It grew, and then you have the Mongols or the Manchus or Chairman Mao's revolution. It's cut off. Then new little shoots grow up from the old thing. So the roots are not entirely destroyed, but there's a very big break for 50, 100 years, and then it starts up again. And that's a very different situation from the one of a tree with a continuous history. So I tried to understand England first, and that was the first 20 years of my life, trying to understand England. I then, and there's some overlap, I then went to Nepal and I tried to understand what it was like to live in a pre-industrial village high up in the Himalayas north of Pokhara. Have any of you been to Nepal? No? You just have to imagine it. There's lots of film. You've been to India. Oh, well, it's getting in the right direction. You'll have to imagine it. But there's lots of film on my YouTube and on my website, including a visit to my village in the only film on what anthropologists actually do in their field, but you want to see it on my website. Anyway, in that village, I found it very difficult to understand when I arrived. Complete culture shock. I didn't speak a word of the language. It was totally different in every way. My assumptions were all challenged. My assumption is that we are individualists. The individual comes first and then the group comes later. But in Nepal it's the opposite right way around, as it is to a certain extent in China and Japan and most societies. I assumed that the agriculture would be much like the history of English agriculture, a lot of use of non-human power, wind and water and animals. Hardly any of that is too steep. And for various reasons, all the work almost is done with the human back and the body. I assumed, because I came from a Christian culture, that religion meant that you were something. You were a Christian, you were a Muslim, you were a Jew. But of course, when I got there, I found that these people regarded religion entirely differently. In fact, there was no such thing as religion in the Western sense. The ethical system, the ritual system, and the beliefs about the afterlife were separate matters and could be dealt with by taking bits out of lots of different religions. So you could be a Buddhist to a certain extent. You could be a shamanic person in other respects. You could be a Hindu in other respects. Or you could be a believer in Western philosophy or medicine or whatever it was in other respects. You put them all together as suited you. And this kind of polytheism was a great shock to someone who had been educated and brought up in the monotheistic systems of the West. But gradually, as I went back and as I studied, I understood it. I went back, I've been back 17 times, almost every year, 15, 16 years, and I have a house there and I have many friends there. And so it became like a second home, and it became very familiar and comprehensible. So when it became too familiar, or very familiar, I decided to try and find another place which would be a surprise. And so I went to, in that case, to Japan. And this has been the greatest intellectual challenge of my life, Japan. Have any of you been to Japan? Yep. Well, I don't know if you, how you got on, but I went in 1990 and I've been back five or six times. And the extraordinary thing about Japan, putting it very briefly, is that it's the opposite of going anywhere else, in that going to Japan, when I first arrived in Narita Airport and went to Hokkaido in the north, I thought, this is very boring, it's just the same as the West, very modern, urban, Western consumer society. Why have I come all this way? Then gradually, as I got to know it more and more and more, it became more and more confusing, mysterious, strange. And it's gone on like that. Each time I go, I feel I know less about it. Normally, you go to India, Nepal, China, and at first it's all sort of surprising, and then gradually you come to understand it. Anyway, through the help of those Japanese friends I mentioned, I gradually began to understand bits of it. And a couple of years ago, I published a book called Japan Through the Looking Glass, which is based on others through the looking glass, in other words, going into a mirror of civilization, trying to write down how I'd come to understand and what I'd come to understand after 15 years working on Japan. Again, it was my unexamined assumptions which got in the way. Firstly, I thought that Japan was a modern civilization which you could apply modern social theory to. You could take Western theories like Max Weber or Durkheim or whatever and understand Japan using it as a kind of grid to understand Japan. After a while, I find that Western social theory is totally useless when applied to Japan. Japan wasn't, couldn't be measured by any Western categories. For example, the oppositions in the West between group and individual, or hierarchy and equality, or all these Western binaries don't work in Japan at all. And I'd assumed that Japan was modern in the sense of Western modernity. And after a while, I realized that it wasn't. It was not pre-modern. It wasn't post-modern either. It was something different. I began to realize that my whole religious background, which had been taken in by the surface of Japan, Japanese religiosity, in other words, lots of temples and shrines and processions and so on. As I probed deeper, I discovered that there is really no religion in Japan, in the Western sense. I can only allude to this, and if you're interested, you could have a look at the book on the subject. In other words, Japan is the extreme other to everything I had understood. Putting it in very, very simply, it had not gone through the great philosophical transformation which affected all the other land-based Eurasian civilizations, what the philosopher Jaspers calls the axial age, the turning on the axis, which occurred in Western philosophies, Chinese philosophies, Indian philosophies, Middle Eastern philosophies about 2,500 years ago. It happened all over, more or less simultaneously, right across Eurasia. But it has never happened in Japan. So it is a what's called a non-axial civilization. So Japan and China are more different from each other than you are as Chinese from me. You have more philosophical overlap, I think, than I have with most of my Japanese friends. And finally, when I'd realized that I was getting as far as I could with Japan, I had the good fortune to encounter the great civilization of China. I went there first in 1996 as a tourist, and then went with a scholar to Liaoning province in 2002, and I've been back almost every year since then with some of my Chinese students as guides and help. That's absolutely essential. I don't speak Chinese, so I was in their hands, but they took me a little bit below the surface of China, and I spent 5 trips, going long tours, spending 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there, a week there, in remote villages with some of you, and in big cities, talking in Chinese universities, and I now have a number of Chinese friends and Chinese students. And the challenge of China is that I haven't yet worked out any sort of way of approaching an overarching understanding of it. And if you have any suggestions in 3 or 4 minutes when I stop, I'd be very grateful for them. I know one or two things. One is that my teacher on the beginnings of my interest in China, who was an anthropologist of China, though he'd never been to most of mainland China, a man called Maurice Friedman at the London School of Economics, said that he thought the way you would understand China is to have detailed community studies of different parts of China as anthropologists, and then you put them together and you get a kind of jigsaw puzzle which all the parts would fit together and you'd understand China. At the time I thought that sounded reasonable. I now think it's a hopeless approach. You certainly, you know, as anthropologists, you need to do that, but you will never understand China by assembling bits together. The reason for this is pointed out by the great philosopher Michael Polanyi. He says, by looking very closely at the several parts of a whole, we may succeed in diverting our attention from the whole and even lose sight of it altogether. Most of these detailed studies tell you about a particular bit, but they don't tell you about anything beyond that bit. And therefore, he says, it's not surprising, therefore, that we may apprehend wholes, we may understand the whole, without ever having focally attended to their particulars. We know this as human beings. When you look at another person, you don't examine each part of their face or their body bit by bit and then understand them. Or when you're driving a car, you don't carefully look at each bit of the road in front of you and then work out the whole thing. You do what is, and in psychology is a Gestalt. You take a kind of photograph of it all in one go. And I think that is why one of the reasons and justifications for the way I'm trying to approach China, which is to take wide sweeping tours through different parts, read generally on it, and hope to come to some understanding of it. And from that I've come to one or two impressions which you may point out to me are completely too simple. These are just one or two of my impressions. Firstly, that central China, that's the Han area, appears to be of moderate difficulty. I don't think that I would find it, if I was young enough and had the energy, as difficult to write a book about China as I did about Japan. But it is difficult because most of its central features are different from mine. The religion of China, although Max Weber and others have written books on the religion of China, is clearly not at all like the monotheistic religions of the West, which is Christianity, Judaism, Islam. The family, this family system, start from different premises from my individualistic Western family system. The imperial political system is totally opposite to the kind of feudal system that's developed in my society. Its agricultural systems are based on the opposite of the kind of cultivation that we have had historically here, not to mention philosophy, language, art, and so on. And because of its huge size and huge historical depth and geographical variety and ethnic complexity with large ethnic minority groups, it's really very, very difficult to see how one could write a short, good book about China, which is what I am always trying to do. On the other hand, I would love to do that if I ever could. I would like to build up a working model which would help me to understand, and maybe others to understand, China. An ideal type, a sort of book similar to the kind that the anthropologist Ruth Benedict wrote about Japan, for something we saw, based on her idea of patterns of culture. In other words, to try and get, as an anthropologist always tries to do, to some deeper level, the rules of the grammar which generate all the surface that you see around you. In searching to do that, several things would be central. Firstly, the ecological system, the grains and the agricultural system, which is so different from Western societies. Secondly, the family system of clans, particularly in southern China. Thirdly, the political, imperial system, the Mandarin system. And then the mixture of philosophies in Confucian, Taoist, Buddhist terms. But I'm not sure that even if I understood all those properly, I would really understand China. When I gave this talk in the previous version in Peking University, I got some helpful suggestions. When I meet leading Chinese scholars, as I do from time to time, I say, tell me three or four books which I must read to understand your culture and civilization. And they give me good suggestions, often Chinese classics of some kind, like the Dream of the Red Dragon or something like that. That usually comes up. Tianzhu Kang, who is a well-known anthropologist, suggested I read a book which I had already read, which was R.H. Tawney's Land and Labour in China, which is a very good book, helped me understand it. But any suggestions you have now or by email of the three or four books I should read, places I should see as keys, and what questions I should ask. My Chinese students here have given me lots of help in that respect, but any more help would be welcome. So basically, to conclude, my life has been like climbing a mountain. The first little ridge mountain was England, until I thought I understood roughly my own society after 15, 20 years. Then Nepal for another 15 or 20 years, until I thought roughly I understood a shamanic Tibetan society. Then Japan, 15 or 20 years. I'm not that old, so these periods overlap a little bit. And now, since 2002, I started climbing a Chinese mountain. Of course, you don't climb this mountain then stop and lose interest. I've continued to be interested in each of these, and I go along the paths several times. But to conclude, I think that one thing I would advise you, and I advise my students, is that keep climbing. It's very easy as an academic or a scholar to find an interesting subject and then spend the rest of your life just working on that. And in terms of economics, the rewards, there are laws of marginal decline or relative decline. After a while, it becomes less interesting and you understand it enough not to see anything more. I'll end with a story of a famous Cambridge biologist, Thompson, who described one Cambridge academic, or a series of academics. He said they were of the cobra kind. A cobra is a kind of snake. I think he went, a python. These are very big, huge snakes, which go along and they eat something. And then when they've eaten a large animal, they go to sleep or just sit there. He said these Cambridge academics were of the cobra kind. They had eaten their intellectual goat early on in their lives, and they spent the rest of their lives gradually digesting it. I could have eaten in England, I could have become a professor of English history and have a reasonable career in that line. I keep getting restless, moving on, and I'm glad to say that even over the rest of my life, China will